Committee on Healthcare to order. It's February 2nd, Groundhog's Day. In the east, the groundhog saw a shadow, so they're going to have a lot more winter, and the groundhog didn't see his shadow here in Oregon, so we get an early spring. So that's the prediction. I would like to welcome you again, and Rick Bacobian is our committee administrator, and Debbie Malone is our committee assistant, and I think that we are going to be under intense pressure to hurry up and pass some bills, but we wanted to start today since we cannot really have a... We're starting with an informational hearing just because yesterday we needed to have 24-hour notice before we could even post a bill. So that's why we may hear and pass Senate Bill 1003 and Senate Bill 1047 today, but it has to be after 9:30 because that was when it was posted for a 24-hour notice. So with that, we would like to have... John, hold it first. We have to adopt the rules. And so I'm going to open an organizational... I would like to have the adoption of committee rules. And could I have a motion?
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 2nd, 2010.
Senator Morris moves that we adopt the proposed committee rules drafted February 2nd, 2010. These are the same boilerplate rules that we've always had. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered. The rules are adopted. And Senator Morris is here, and Senator Morissette is here. And I know that Senator Bates, Senator Cruz are on their way. With that, I'd like to ask, I'll close the informational organizational meeting and open an informational meeting on Oregon healthcare financing proposal and call John DiLorenzo and Paul Warner up. And this has been a conversation that has been going on for almost a year. Over a year, probably. I remember when I had dinner with some folks discussing this idea, and Mr. DiLorenzo had asked if he could present this concept, and I said, absolutely. So, with that, take it away.
Morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John DiLorenzo. I'm a partner at the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine. I'm grateful for your kind invitation to appear today to discuss a financing proposal for expanding health care to all Oregonians and vastly increasing job opportunities in our state. I am not appearing here this morning on behalf of any particular client. Rather, I am here to discuss an idea, one which has never up until now been fashioned to address Oregon's peculiar circumstances and opportunities. I have attached my opinion piece, which was published in last Sunday's Oregonian. In it, I suggested that the failings of our healthcare system are due to many design flaws, most notably the linkage of healthcare benefits to employment status. I truly believe that the system's failures will persist unless and until we exercise the necessary leadership to separate healthcare from employment status, and also to acknowledge that it is a proper role for our government to protect our citizens from disease, every bit as much as it is appropriate for our government to protect its citizens from crime or to provide a basic level of education services. Unfortunately, most of the plans which have been considered in Congress, the Massachusetts health care plan, health care plans adopted by other states, and even the plan envisioned by Oregon's Health Fund Board, are all dependent upon employer contributions and provider taxes for attaining their goals. Senator Wyden's Healthy Americans Act did provide some mechanism for eventually weaning employer contributions from healthcare costs, but even that proposal required employers to pay a tax between 3 and 26% of the national average premium for a minimum benefits package. Now that Congress is likely to postpone, alter, or abandon portions of the major overhaul plans, I believe emphasis should once again be focused on how Oregonians can provide basic health care for our own citizens. There are some who feel that health care should be a personal responsibility. Those who feel that way presume that they have a choice between the various health care reforms that have been proposed and the status quo, which they prefer to maintain. Their mistake is in assuming that the status quo is sustainable. It really isn't a choice. Healthcare costs to employers have risen dramatically over the past 10 years. Healthcare costs have risen substantially this year and will continue to rise until employers will simply no longer be able to afford them. As time goes on, healthcare will become less affordable to our citizens through their employers or the private markets, and as Oregon's economy continues to stagnate, the newly unemployed will have nowhere to turn when their benefits expire. Even the Oregon Health Plan has been temporarily, and in my view unsustainably, propped up by $883 million of federal stimulus money. What will happen when the stimulus funds run out in 2011? Will those who make up the 15% increased caseload be out of luck at that point? Well, I have proposed a quality health care system covering every one of Oregon's citizens. I envision a plan that would provide coverage for preventative care like yearly medical, dental, eye exams, and would also provide for catastrophic coverage, including hospitalization when surgery or other significant care might be required. The plan would also provide for other basic services as foreseen by the Oregon Health Fund Board report, which I have read and much of which I embrace and agree with. The guaranteed policy would provide minimum coverages as an essential benefits package and would allow individuals or employers opportunities to access the market to purchase enhancement benefits if they so chose. So there would be basic benefits and then to the market for enhancement benefits. The essential benefits package could be serviced by existing providers and new out-of-state providers who would ultimately enter the market if the antitrust rules are amended in Congress. Oregon could issue either vouchers in the form of health savings cards, or it could issue requests for proposals for private administrators to bid for state contracts at the least cost for the entire population base. Of course, many Oregon businesses still offer health care benefits to their employees today. That's true. Although they strive to maximize benefits, their plans are expensive on a per-person basis. Their blessings become their curses. They are blessed with many long-tenured employees, some who have been with them for years. Their curse, of course, is that the long-tenured, loyal employees are aging and are now required to access health care services more often than they did in years past. However, their employees could be provided the same level of services for much lower cost per person if they happened to be part of a group that was as large as the entire state of Oregon. That is because the entire state's population includes the state's healthiest people. It is true that many Oregon families are uninsured because they simply can no longer afford the cost of health insurance. However, many persons in this state are uninsured because they are young and feel they don't need to be insured. Many do not even consider purchasing health insurance until they become much older and begin to recognize the need to draw upon the system. The plan I envision would therefore take full advantage of capitation, including by definition every citizen in the state of Oregon who met certain residency requirements, and I do that to manage the potential in-state migration that could result otherwise. Now, although many employers would choose to provide extra benefits to their employees through collective bargaining agreements or on their own, Oregon employers generally would no longer be expected to pay health care premiums for the essential benefits package. The package would be personal to every Oregonian and portable to them, regardless of employment status. Oregonians would have new freedoms, no longer reliant on their employers for health care. Every Oregonian would pay his or her fair share of this coverage based on his or her consumption. Unlike various federal plans under discussion, there would be no fines or punitive measures taken to force anyone to pay the premium. Rather, the premium would be automatic in the form of a constitutionally dedicated sales tax for health care, which could not be diverted or increased without a vote of the public. Because the sales tax would really be a health care premium, everyone who purchased covered goods or services other than exempt items would pay a fair premium for the basic health care coverages we would all enjoy. Over the last several months, the Legislative Revenue Office has fielded questions concerning revenues which could be raised by various standard-based or broad-based sales taxes. And Mr. Werner is here this morning, and I know is prepared to share some of that updated information with you. The precise plan that I am proposing assumes that approximately $10 billion per year would provide an essential benefits package to every citizen of the state. The cost could, of course, be more or less depending upon the nature of the benefits and the deductibles that would be involved. In order to raise this amount, we would likely require an approximate 7% sales tax on goods and services, which would compare to Seattle, Washington's 9% on retail goods. This could raise approximately $6 billion annually. Added to that would be an extra $910 million, which could be redirected from the general fund because employers would no longer take deductions for health care insurance. In addition, approximately $280 million could be redirected from the general fund because employers would no longer take deductions from any cafeteria plan benefits. Additional revenue savings would occur from the loss of other federal exclusions and deductions, which Mr. Werner can further elaborate on. Added to that would be the savings the state would incur because we would no longer have required Oregon Health Plan expenditures. They would be subsumed into the essential benefits package. Added to that would be the maximum possible federal matching because this plan would, by definition, cover every single matchable person. Every senior and every child would be covered. Savings would likely come from other quarters. For instance, in 2007, our total workers' compensation cost was $570 million. The medical portion of that was $320 million. The disability portion was $256 million. This plan could, need not, but could cover many of the medical expenses now currently expended by the workers' compensation system, too. We would derive other savings, many of which would be difficult to initially assess, but which would be real nonetheless. For instance, there would be fewer expensive emergency room visits by the formerly uninsured because any Oregon citizen, and especially our children, could now visit a doctor for maladies before they became so severe as to require emergency medical treatment. The state and providers would have significant administrative savings since pre-qualifications would no longer require mounds of paperwork, but only a driver's license or other proof of citizenship and residency. There would be other advantages associated with constitutionally dedicating a sales tax to health care. First, everyone would pay. There would be no free riders. Even visitors and those engaged in the illegal and underground economies would pay for Oregon's health care because they all buy goods and services. Second, the dedicated sales tax would really be a health insurance premium, because each person's health insurance premium would be based upon their consumption. Their contribution would be a fair estimate of what they could afford to pay, because it would be based on what they could afford to buy. However, one of the most significant silver linings of this plan would be its potential for economic development and specifically job formation. We are one of the very few states in the nation that could dedicate a sales tax to a uniform system of health care because we are one of the very few states that has no sales tax. Other states would have to raise their sales taxes to the point where severe economic dislocations would result. Because we are the only state on the West Coast that could, practically speaking, dedicate our sales tax to this purpose, we are also the only state that could eliminate an employer's burden for financing the essential benefits package. No nearby state could replicate that advantage to employers. Labor-intensive businesses would look to Oregon as a place where they could locate headquarters or facilities and save 15% or more of their payroll costs by virtue of no longer having to pay for the essential benefits. This would place Oregon at an incredible economic competitive advantage with respect to our other states. As hundreds of employers, new employers, began to locate in Oregon, the state would in turn derive even more income tax receipts from their profits and more income tax from the newly employed Oregonians as we would move towards a full employment economy. Now, I've attached some materials to my testimony, including my opinion piece, Senator Morse's chart, which I have shamelessly borrowed and revised to reflect my proposal. Thank you, Senator. A page describing what a gross receipts tax might raise and its disadvantages, in my opinion, and a table recently updated by the Legislative Revenue Office sharing what revenues various types of sales taxes might raise. One final word on the politics of all of this. I have followed very closely each sales tax initiative since the 80s. I attribute the failure of every sales tax proposal since the mid-1980s to one overriding concern. The proposals all lumped the new revenues into the general fund. Each time the voters viewed a sales tax as just another tax on top of the taxes we currently pay. As far as I know, no one has ever proposed that a sales tax be dedicated to provide health care benefits for all. Sales taxes may initially be a tough sell, I acknowledge that, but the previously failed attempts and the public opinion polling, which from time to time emerges on this subject, should not be the end-all of that analysis. Those prior indicators only reflect that the tax was improperly structured or show an initial disfavor by the voters in a vacuum, absent leadership. The current electorate, I think, given leadership, might view a constitutionally dedicated sales tax to finance basic health care as preferable to the prospect of the loss of their health care, given how precarious each person's job happens to be nowadays and how unsustainable the current system really is. The electorate might also realize that Oregonians would have new freedoms under this proposal, no longer reliant on their employers having to maintain, stay in that job merely to preserve their health care benefits. Madam Chair, I ask that your committee take steps to embark upon a hard look at this option and making available the resources of the Legislative Revenue Office and others to determine how a system like this might work in practice. Assuming there is sufficient interest on your part, I am committed to bringing together members of our business community and political leaders who currently find themselves in polarized camps following Tuesday's election. It is my hope that business expertise can be combined with public desires to move forward in a proactively and a bipartisan way. What a great thing it would be if we could make basic health care available to every one of our citizens, especially every child, and generate thousands of private sector jobs besides. That, Madam Chair, in my opinion, would be in the best of Oregon's tradition. I thank you very much for your kind invitation and for your committee's time, and I'm available to answer your questions either now or after Mr. Warner has had an opportunity to make his presentation.
What's the committee's wish? Go ahead. Go ahead, Paul, and then we'll open it up for questions.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office. I think you've got a one-page handout there on titled Health Care Revenue. I'll walk through that with you a little bit and answer any questions you may have. The first part of the handout there looks at just summarizes the major tax expenditures as a result of the healthcare system through the income tax, through Oregon's income tax. We track this and kind of have a separate block for health related because we've looked at this issue a number of times in the past. And as I think as John pointed out, the number one area is employer-paid medical benefits that results from a federal exclusion. Other large categories include the medical and dental expenses above 7.5% of adjusted gross income. Related to that, down the list is the elderly medical organ subtraction, which is for 60 seniors 62 and above. They can deduct all of their medical expenses up to the 7.5%, and then the federal deduction kicks in for through the connection to the federal tax code. Those numbers you see there in the right-hand column are the estimates contained in the 0911 tax expenditure report that the Department of Revenue puts together every biennium with the governor's recommended budget. And you can see the summary there. There's a whole series of other credits involved there, too. And some of those may or may not be part of a health financing plan, but the summary of the sum of all of those would be roughly $2.3 billion for the biennium.
Just a question here. Medicare is federal.
This is the supplemental. This the hospital is a Part A, and that's the supplemental income that comes through the program. That's excluded.
So these deductions would go away if we went with a sales tax. Thank you.
Yes. These would be potential revenue sources through the income tax that, in effect, subsidize health care. The next box there looks at potential revenue from a sales tax base, and of course we've my office has looked at this for 30 years now, and so we have sales tax calculators, and we tie them back to personal income for the state. One of the things we track is a percentage of personal income for all the sales tax bases around the country. So when we go through and do kind of a bottom-up estimate, we can do a top-down comparison where we would be. The first row there, I'm using the 2010-11 fiscal year, and kind of what we do is we take the calendar year numbers and assume there's a six-month lag there for the fiscal year in collections and derive our estimates. Our standard base there is one we've worked with bills that have been proposed in the past. For example, Senator Morse's bill from last session, we used this standard base, and you can see the list of exemptions there that would be part of that. We'll go through the consumer expenditure survey and try to calculate what those proportions would be. The tax base would be right about 50% of personal income. That's slightly higher than what Washington is right now. Typically, of course, what would happen in a sales tax discussion would be extensive discussion around what should be exempted. And those of you who go back to the last detailed effort in the Revenue Committees to do this back in 93, there were literally just weeks of testimony on what should be exempted, what shouldn't be. So, but these are roughly parallel to what we see in other states as a percent of the base. What you get on that revenue is just short of $700 million per percent. And that's how that works out. For example, the 7% on the standard base would be about 4.9. And again, these are annual numbers, so you double that for a biennium. On the second row, a broad base. This would be a broader base than what we see in most states. The broadest base out there in terms of this percentage of personal income is New Mexico, and this would be less than New Mexico, but be closer to their base than most other retail sales tax states. And the major exemptions there are listed: shelter, in-home food, and utilities. And you can see the amount generated by each percentage would be about $6.1 billion from a 7% rate. These estimates are down a little bit. We worked with Senator Morse during the regular session. These estimates are down because they're tied to the December revenue forecast. So they're ultimately gets back to personal income as the driver on this. Our personal income estimates are lower than they were back the last spring. So that's why we see a little bit lower estimates than we were looking at a year ago. A couple of things to keep in mind about the kind of the standard U.S. retail sales tax base. Consumers make up about 60% of that base typically. Businesses make up about 25% of the base, 25 to 30, depending on the treatment of services primarily. You have the amount of retail or the amount of export activity runs 3 to 5%. We have a component in there for non-residents because we have a large non-resident group that would be coming down from Vancouver primarily. So we have an adjustment for that as well. But I think one of the things a lot of people don't realize is that business does pay the retail sales tax, even though it's thought of as a retail tax, because there's a lot of business-to-business purchases. And that's typical of how that base works in most states.
Say again what percentage consumers would pay.
Consumers would pay, the household estimates would be right about 60% of that. And about 25 to 30% usually comes on business-to-business purchases, and about 3 to 5% on non-residents. We make an additional couple of percent adjustment for the amount of daily in migration we have. There's a non-resident adjustment, and we try to account for that, primarily commuters. So those are estimates, and we would, of course, the one thing advantage we have in these estimates, and although anytime you're going to a new base, they're always very uncertain, but we do have a lot of other states to compare to and scale to, and particularly Washington. We have a lot of detailed information from Washington.
Well, I find this very novel, and I guess there are a lot of questions regarding defining an essential benefits plan, and what does that mean to the consumer if they need more care than what the essential benefits plan, and how would those kinds of things be worked out? Do you have any comments on that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, John DiLorenzo. That's true. It is difficult to say at this point what an essential benefits package would consist of. I could give you my views as to what should be in them, but knowing this process, I know that the end product would likely have little resemblance to what I might prefer out of the box. But that's a question that we're going to face in any context.
That the health authority is working on.
The board is involved in pursuing that analysis right now. My own vision is that there should be basic essential services that every Oregonian should deserve. After that, if people wanted to expand their care and their benefits opportunities, they could go to the market to purchase up enhancements. I presume businesses that are currently offering what are referred to as Cadillac plans would probably, under this scenario, rely on the basic benefits package for every one of its employees, and then through collective bargaining agreements or ERISA plans, purchase up add-ons on top of that to get back to parity and still offer the same kind of plans that they were used to. The difference is, every Oregonian, though, would be assured that if anything catastrophic occurred, they'd be taken care of. And they wouldn't have to stay in a dead-end job to maintain that. They'd have it. I hope they would be much happier. I think they probably would. It'd be a brand-new freedom. And it would provide for a much healthier workforce. And small businesses that could never afford health care would, of course, have a workforce that was healthier.
Senator Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, I want to thank you for bringing forward what I consider really a bold idea and initiative. I know there's been a work group on this sort of behind the scenes. It's been very bipartisan, Republican and Democrats and others looking at this and talking about it. I want to congratulate those people for that work. I think it's something that's well worth discussing and looking at really, really carefully. Huge number of details involved here yet, of course. Massive. But the basic concept, I think, is an excellent one, and one we need to take seriously and spend some time looking at over the next 8, 9, 10 months, and then a long discussion in a full session. The hurdles are huge. You got to climb Mount Everest to do this thing, but it doesn't say it can't be done. I do have a couple of questions that have occurred to me and I've been thinking about for the last couple of months of this, and if you can't answer them today, don't feel bad. And Mr. Warren, maybe more towards you than towards the other side. I think of things like the benefit package, which to me is not a huge issue. I think that can be defined rather quickly. Utilization is a huge problem inside healthcare issues, and utilization is what's really driving this thing. Lack of primary and preventative care, and yet these aren't being discussed in this, and they shouldn't be. This is something for the health authority to take care of to help drive costs down. What this does do is take care of cost shift. Now, this would be a significant factor. Probably 10 to 15% of our health care costs are what we talk about, the cost of what you mentioned here today. And that would be a huge step forward. But I have some, I can't quite wrap my head around a couple issues, Paul, that I think you can answer for me and help me through here, because it's an area that I have only limited knowledge, and that's the tax codes. So if we eliminate the federal deductions for employer-paid medical benefits, Part A, B, and maybe even D of Medicare, and we sort of shift them into a sales tax instead, is that sales tax deductible for corporations and individuals against their income tax or federal income tax? What I'm thinking here is we're already a donor state of the federal government, and I don't want to become a bigger donor state of the federal government through this.
Senator Bates, for a business, any tax that would be paid, so it would be a business-to-business sales tax, would be deductible as a business expense on their corporate return, or if it's even a sole proprietor that's filed Schedule C, it'll be an expense that they could take off their gross sales. For individuals, the way the federal government has gone, as you recall with the federal reform back in the 80s, sales taxes were eliminated as a federal deduction. Now, in recent years, going back to, I believe, 05, the federal government has had a period in which the taxpayers may choose which to deduct. So they can either deduct a sales tax or a personal income tax, but not both. So there would be, and that oddly in my mind, it leads to almost an incentive to have a less diversified state system. But that's the way current law is now. There is a sunset on the sales tax deduction. It's been renewed a couple of times. But the sales tax states like Washington, for example, of course, have been strong advocates. So that's the way it stands right now. It's an either-or deduction on the personal return.
And Madam Chair and Senator Bates, if I can just add one thing, this proposal does not envision a statutory elimination of these deductions. It just acknowledges that there's nothing to deduct because employers are not paying for the basic health care expenses. Therefore, there is no expense which they would in turn deduct off of their income taxes. And so the numbers on Mr. Warner's column reflects the number of deductions that would still be theoretically available in the tax code, but which would not be taken advantage of because there were no expenditures, because businesses didn't have to spend that money.
Unless a business wanted to offer supplements to the essential benefits package.
Yes, and Madam Chair, many businesses would do that either because of their collective bargaining agreements or because of their ERISA plans or for competitive reasons.
Mm-hmm. So some of it still would exist, I believe. We just wouldn't know how much.
Mm-hmm. No, follow up. Mm-hmm. Mr. Warner, to get a deduction, you got to spend some money first, so it's a false promise. My point of view, I always think of it that way, so deduction isn't always that good a deal. But having said that, and we're shifting this from an employer-based situation for paying premiums to an individual-based premium, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, because I don't remember this one either. Individuals buying insurance premiums right now, I don't believe, can deduct that from their federal income tax, whereas corporations and employers can. But there were some changes in that law, and I'm not sure I'm up to date anymore.
The insurance premiums count as a medical expense. So they do count, for example, under the senior medical subtraction.
Okay.
And so if you're paying, somebody 62 years and over can deduct that on the Oregon return, and if it gets over 7.5%, then you would fall into the federal deduction.
Okay. And here's the question I'm actually leading up to, the final question, because I need to kind of lay the framework in my own mind for this. This is a sales tax dedicated purely to paying health insurance premiums, essentially. Okay, through a voucher or through a specific, you'd be spending the money only for health insurance. Is it conceivable this could be presented to the federal government not as a sales tax, but as an insurance premium, which would be fully deductible as well as the taxes paid by individuals and corporations of the state to the state of Oregon?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates,
why wouldn't it be?
Had some conversations with Senator Wyden about some of the general principles surrounding this this proposal, and I would think that that would be something he would immediately want to jump on, mm-hmm. being on the Finance Committee.
It would seem appropriate that this really makes this fly. We would keep our deductibility. We wouldn't characterize this necessarily as a sales tax. It would be calculated as a sales tax, but in fact would be a broad-based premium for health insurance for the citizens of the state of Oregon. Paul, you seem to be smiling. Well, is this too cute, or is it something we can actually work with?
Well, Senator, I don't think I can comment on what the federal reaction would be, but obviously, if it is interpreted that way, the benefits to the Oregon economy would be significant, because as you say, we would significantly reduce the federal tax burden, and that, as a result, would mean more of that revenue stays within the state.
That's all I've asked.
Okay, Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, John and Paul, for this information. My question focuses on the payer mix. And if you look at Medicare, Medicaid, commercial, and the no-pay, you find that the Medicaid, Medicare combined is in some places in excess of 50% of the healthcare dollar. And the Medicare is probably on average 40 to 45%. How would you envision blending the Medicare into this kind of a funding system?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, thank you for the question. And it exposes an issue that I have been trying to work through, and that is how would we treat seniors under this program. Seniors would pay the sales tax, obviously, for purchases. Most of them are already covered by Medicare. My mother is covered by Medicare. She rarely has trouble getting to see her doctor. But unfortunately, the drugs that he prescribes cost her about $850 a month. And so, you know, to some extent, it is a Pyrrhic victory to be able to go to the doctor, but yet not be able to afford the drugs that will address the malady. I would hope that there could be something in this for seniors, and that possibly the fund that we would amass, because seniors were already covered by Medicare, could be used to enhance their prescription drug coverage. And I think that would be a wonderful benefit for seniors. Mm-hmm.
As a follow-up, yes. Madam Chair, I see one of the very, very significant advantages of this concept is essentially rationalizing a broken delivery system. And if you look at a profit and loss statement of a hospital, what you find is it's a strange accounting system, because you look at charges and then you have deductions from charges. And those deductions from revenues are, in some cases, in excess of 40%, which is a strange system. And then you have a weighted allocation based on commercial, the no-pay, the Medicare, Medicaid, and it's a pricing system that you would never invent. And you look at the declining commercial base of the payer mix, and the system is not going to be, it isn't going to be around in the future. So it begs the question, what are we going to do to rationalize this system? One that has, you know, at least in our system in the Mid-Valley, you know, up to 10% of essentially no pay. charitable and uncollectible debt. So there are a lot of advantages, I think, of rationalizing the system from the payer side, which will really focus, it will transfer into the delivery side. If you might maybe speak to that.
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, I think I alluded to this in my testimony, that there are many other benefits which are tough to put a number on specifically, but would result nevertheless, and one would be just that. Currently, we provide a significant amount of charity care. Anyone who shows up has to be treated by a hospital. And what normally happens is that people wait until their symptoms become so severe and their problems become so severe that they need emergency treatment. And that emergency treatment is 5 to 10 times as expensive as it would have been had we treated them initially. Under this plan, every person, especially every child, would go to the doctor weeks and months before the problem would get to the point where they would have to seek emergency medical care. So I am hoping that we would be able to funnel people into primary care and eliminate this huge wasteful expenditure. And we cover it all anyway. Now, the people say, well, health care should be your personal responsibility. Well, some people just can't swing it one way or the other, and they end up going to a place where it costs 10 times as much to treat them, and we pay for it all anyway. So let's just get real and try to funnel these people early on when we can treat them fairly inexpensively.
Senator Morse.
Two things. Thank you very much for bringing this plan. I believe health care is a basic human right that everyone should have. The main objection to a sales tax has been the regressive nature of the sales tax. I don't see this as being regressive.
Comment?
Well, this is an interesting thing, because every penny that a person spends would help pay for his or her health care. So it is not a I don't see it as a regressive tax.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Morissette, I don't view it, people think of regressive two ways. One is the tax definition, which is either a regressive tax or a progressive system. I believe there is some regressivity, obviously, associated with it, because everybody pays the same rate with a sales tax. Now, the regressivity is tempered through exemptions, but you have to look at the alternative. I can't think of anything more regressive than a health care premium. I mean, a health care premium has absolutely no bearing on one's ability to pay. At least the sales tax for health care plan would allow people to contribute towards their health care based upon their ability to pay. And so I think it would be a major step towards progressivity.
Mm-hmm.
But I would hope that those who feel that a sales tax is regressive would look at it the same way you do, that this would be a major, major improvement on the system.
Well, that was my first blush look. But it just strikes me as being, that it eliminates, I think, the regressivity of the fact that you're paying more of your income in taxes than people who have a lot of money, even though they buy more expensive things. But the fact that any money spent on a sales tax, any money spent on purchases, would go toward the premium. So in that sense, I think it does solve, address that problem. And I congratulate you.
Well, thank you.
Senator Cruz?
Yeah, a couple things. I've been involved in this a little bit. Number one, this is not a silver bullet. I mean, the ultimate equation comes down to math, and it's units of care and cost per unit.
Right.
And so to assume that this gives everybody everything they want all the time would be foolish, because I don't think there's a system that will do that. Because we are talking basics here at this point in time. I guess my warning at this point is, until we have done some significant things to stop the escalation in the system, this won't work because we'll continue to outprice ourselves. And so until we can do some real tort reform and a few other things like that, it's just a warning, and we've had this conversation, but until we can get some stability to the system itself, we run the risk of creating a system that continues to escalate and becomes unaffordable as well. For us to be able to sell this to the people, there has to be a level of certainty that you know, I agree that one of the reasons the sales taxes failed every time is just more money into the general fund from a different source, but then they also look around and see that most states who have started a sales tax have started really low and have just grown it over time. And the constitutional guarantee does deal with that, but we don't want to create a situation where we're setting up false expectations, that we look at the system as it is now, and this is the rate of the sales tax we create, put it in the Constitution, which would mean it would be really, really hard to increase it, which is, in my mind, a good thing. But at the same time, then we build a system that prices itself out of the system we've created. So we've all had these conversations about the things we need to do on the front end to kind of stabilize the system itself. And so all of those things need to be taken into consideration and dealt with at least at the same time as we move forward with this concept.
Madam Chair and Senator Cruz, I do have one thought on that point. Obviously, cost containment is not an issue that is directed particularly at this proposal. It involves all proposals.
Right.
I understand that is one of the charges that the Oregon Health Fund Board is investigating in the
Health House Authority.
Or Health Authority now, excuse me. Thank you, Senator. And the House Bill 2009 process is also envisioning. But my thinking here is that this plan could count, I think, on discipline among providers to help us contain costs, because one of the ways we could work this, frankly, is to issue RFPs and ask providers to come in and bid the contract for 2 years. It could be in various regions of the state. There's all kinds of ways to set it up. But if we say, all right, providers, here's $10 billion. We expect you to maintain this level of services. Can you do it? They say yes. They sign up for the contract. I have a feeling that they're going to exercise enough self-discipline to engage in cost containment, to be able to deliver the level of services that they've contracted for the price that we have paid. And so I do believe that this system would encourage that type of discipline within the provider community, and the market would provide that kind of discipline too. Now, it's not the end-all, but it's at least a step in the right direction.
And we do want to give direction to the health authority regarding cost containment in their health plan as it is. So I think that's a goal that we will need to work on. Senator Bates and then Senator Morissette.
No, a couple of issues just real quickly. I'm going to play off yours first. One of the big drivers in healthcare costs is not just the cost shift, which you've spoken to and I've spoken to today, but administrative costs.
Mm-hmm.
Probably something in the neighborhood of 30%, which should be somewhere around the neighborhood of 10 to 12%. Having one funding source, one major funding source for healthcare, would drive us to a single administrative cost, I think very quickly, especially if that was under an authority or some other agency. And you could look at that from the point of view of what the SAFE model has done, too, for costs. It really drove costs in one direction because it came from one source, a similar source to this, actually. It's a payroll tax, if you can look at it that way. So I think you've got two areas you could attack cost on by this plan. It isn't everything. Utilization is still the major driver in healthcare, and the lack of primary and preventative care is still the major driver, but those are things outside the realm of this particular plan. I want to go back to what Senator Morris is asking about seniors, what's in it for seniors. There's a couple of very big things in it for seniors that you may not have had a chance to look into. The first is that the state of Oregon, along with six other states and possibly seven other states, is the lowest payment state for Medicare in the United States. It's becoming a growing problem in the state. We're having fewer physicians who will accept Medicare patients. Not so much in the Portland area, which is higher paid than the rest of the state, but in the rest of the state, it's becoming a real issue. And more physicians are disenrolling from the Medicare programs. And as that becomes larger, it's going to be more important that people go into Medicare Advantage programs and others. Part of that is being resolved by higher premiums paid by seniors to get supplemental programs to Medicare. It's becoming a real burden for some of these people. Some of these premiums are now reaching $150 to $200 a month per individual in addition to the Medicare benefit they get. I would assume that would come under this plan.
Yeah.
And that the payment of that would be important. Many Medicare beneficiaries are dropping Part D, which is the part that pays for their pharmaceuticals, because they don't want to pay the monthly cost to it. And about, depending on the individual, in the middle of the year or later in the year, they hit the donut hole, which is a huge cost to them of about $2,500 a month. And a donut hole means that your Medicare benefit for your pharmaceuticals runs out and doesn't pick up again until you go above a certain amount of money. So the donut hole, which is talked about all the time by patients, physicians, is a very real thing. Those issues would be resolved by this plan. It's a huge benefit to most Medicare beneficiaries, and they understand that. The other one you may not be aware of is something called dual eligibles. You ever heard of those? It's individuals in Medicare who have such low income that they become eligible also for Medicaid benefits. They have Medicare and Medicaid benefits. And the Medicaid benefits pays their premium and pays their pharmaceutical costs. Again, it's unsustainable for us. Medicaid cannot continue to pay for those dual eligibles in the long run, I believe, and this plan would take care of that also. So there's two huge benefits to look at here if you're going to talk about this with seniors, and they're really big. Low-income, middle-income Medicare beneficiaries will understand this immediately. High-income individuals, they can pay their premium. They'll take care of the pharmaceutical costs, but as you know with your own mother, they can be pretty tough.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So I just wanted to bring that out and let you know about it. There is a huge benefit for seniors in this.
Senator Morsett.
To follow up on Senator Bates, there is a prescription drug program, benefit program, OPDP, Oregon Prescription Drug Program, that has free cards to every single person in the state. And if you are on Medicaid in the donut hole, you can use that card and get about a 60% discount on drugs and count that as out-of-pocket to get through the donut hole. I wanted to go back to, though, the cost drivers and the primary care to keep people out of the emergency room. We do have universal health care in Oregon right now. It is called the emergency room. And the costs are huge. Now, if this plan is all that it's supposed to be, which I think it sounds pretty good, that would allow people to get the primary care they need to keep them out of the emergency room. It would solve part of that problem. And I think that any plan that is put in place has a tremendous initial cost because people have been delaying their, medical treatment, and suddenly there's a huge, that's what happened in Massachusetts that almost, ruined their program. So I think this is a good plan in, relieving the cost shift to the hospitals, and cost shift is one of the major things. The other issue is tort reform, which I do think we need. We are one of 11 states that does not have caps on tort action. And I'd like to see the state of Oregon do what Idaho does and have mandatory mediation before a suit goes to trial. Of course, lawyers are afraid. They don't like that because they have to put all their cards on the table, and that kind of takes the wind out of their sails if they have to reveal their strategy. But it has been effective in Idaho and other states that have tried that. So these are some of the cost drivers, and I think that your plan might address some of them.
Senator Morris.
Thank you. We've had a little discussion the last several months about jobs and the economy, and it's been a statewide discussion. I see this, and I'm reading here where you addressed business issue and the advantages. I think, John, you probably understated the advantages. If you look at blending the workers' comp system into a health delivery system, and the ability for Oregon to be a very fertile ground, a competitive place, this is revolutionary from a competitive standpoint nationwide. And I think that the impacts, to see this thing modeled and worked out in the future, the benefits to jobs and our economy would be profound. I just firmly believe that. And at a time when that's a timely discussion. Thank you, Madam Chair.
We're at the end of the hour, and I would like to see work continue on this. And I'm not sure that a work group is, I think that there really should be some formalized group coming together to make sure that we don't lose some momentum in taking this forward. I think it would be appropriate to, if you could make this presentation to the health authority, because I think that we need to have, since we have this huge infrastructure in the making, that they need to be a part of this, since we have sort of dedicated a tremendous amount. But if they are not in the position to want to respond to it, I feel that we could go forward with a bill in 2011 to start working on it. And of course it would have to start in the House, and I was glad to see that Representative Barnhart was here. He's here for another topic we're going to be talking about shortly, but I'm glad that he was listening so that we can go forward. Because my biggest concern, well, first of all, businesses, I think, would love this. And I think that if proper education, I think the public would too. The problem is the word sales tax. And our culture in this state is so anti-sales tax. So there would be a tremendous amount of education and polling that would need to be done. But I think we need to sort of have a product first and a lot of education.
Just very briefly, call it a premium tax, not a sales tax. It's a premium tax, right?
Madam Chair, I struggled with this. And on the one hand, I would love to come up with a euphemism for it. On the other hand, if I did, people would say, oh, it's a disguised sales tax.
I would rather
call it what it is and attack it head on. It is not a pejorative term, a sales tax.
And sales premium.
But if the public knew that, a certain amount of money is not coming out of their paycheck, they're going to have more disposable income to be able to do whatever they want, so to speak, even though they will be paying a sales tax. So I would like, if I'm going to take direction from you on, because I know that Senator Morris has worked on this and Senator Cruz. I've attended a couple of meetings. I don't know if Senator Bates was. So there are a number of us that are extremely interested in going forward. We can't have a quorum from this committee, but let's just broadly say that we're going to have a work group with Rick Berkovian sort of organizing, and when we are ready to go forward during the interim, we will meet. And I would say we would probably choose from those that have already been involved, Morris, Bates, Cruz, and myself, but no more than two of us at any one meeting, because then we'd have a quorum.
Madam Chair, we haven't had a bill to deal with, so we haven't had quorum issues. We've just been talking general.
Oh, good point.
General things. I do have a question for Paul. If this is a constitutional referral, even though it has to do with taxes, does it still have to start in the House?
If it's a constitutional referral, no, it doesn't.
Yeah, so we could take, I thought so, and I think we can take the lead on it because it isn't a tax bill, it's a referral.
Right.
So, mm-hmm. Yeah. So, but at this point in time, Madam Chair, we have no bill. We're just talking concepts, so we don't have quorum issues.
And Madam Chair, if I could also ask that we have as many preliminary discussions as we possibly can in February. Most of the business community and other affected players are here in the building. I would love to not let this opportunity go by to have some real honest discussions about the proposal. You have my commitment to help facilitate, along with your committee administrator, putting some of these discussion groups together. There's frankly nothing I enjoy more than trying to bring people with disparate views together to arrive on an agreement. And it's a very exciting prospect, especially if we can move forward to fulfill a real pressing need and stimulate our economy at the same time.
Well, let's work on, say, forming a committee, probably a work group, I should say, not a committee, but a work group. Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays work best for me. I'm not sure the rest of
you. Madam Chair, we're not going to form a work group. We're just going to have people get together and talk. I don't want anything official because then you also run into quorum issues.
All right. That's fine with me. But we will look at getting a time, place, and make sure that the appropriate people are invited. And of course,
there you go. Very unofficial.
It'll be very unofficial. All right. Yes, Senator B.
I think we need to get the health authority involved in this very quickly. They've got some assets that we need to use. One is they'll have a chance to use some of their actuaries. We got some really big numbers here to look at and be sure that we're on solid ground as far as our estimates of cost and revenue is concerned. Paul will probably need people from your department also to come and help us with this to make sure we are on solid ground as far as revenue is concerned, not only from what we'd be collecting the revenue side, but that it's legal to do what we're trying to do as far as federal laws are concerned, too. And the plan is great. The question is, some of the, and I must say the devil of details, huge details, major parts of this have to be looked at very carefully before we go too far down the road. And Health Authority and Uber can really help us out in this. And we'll contact them, and Madam Chair, with your permission, I would like to make that phone call for you, or you can do it yourself.
Well, Amy Fave, who is the government relations liaison, is sitting in the back, so I know that she will be...
We
conveying this to the health
really
authority.
Big discussion.
Senator Morris?
I was just going to follow up, Madam Chair, with the comment that Senator Bates made. You know, we've heard this, and a letter from the chair and the vice chair jointly to the health authority with a specific request that follow-up work be done to try to model and flesh out the details might be appropriate because it moves it from the informal to the formal expression of our interest as a legislative body.
We can do that.
Absolutely. So we will work with our committee administrator and get a letter out, and we'll go forward.
Great.
All right.
Thank you so much. I know you have a packed agenda, and I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. All right. Well,
that was fun.
Always exciting to be a little innovative and come forward with something that maybe can truly help
Chair,
businesses, help Oregonians.
Madam Chair, this is not a little innovative.
Okay.
A real, yeah, real call.
Okay. Okay, with that, I'm going to close the informational hearing on the Oregon Healthcare Financing Proposal and open an informational hearing on the Psychologist Prescriptive Authority. Okay, who would like to come up first?
What are we doing?
I have here Rob. Is there someone who wants to do a little summary of what has happened?
That was so good to hear.
Robin? Robin Henderson and Donna Silverberg, come forward. Okay, Donna, come forward. So, Donna, I know that you gave us a summary last committee meeting in the interim. Could you just briefly bring us up to date on what, where we are at on the psychologist prescriptive authority and the work group?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Donna Silverberg. I'm a mediator and facilitator out of the Portland area. Pleasure to be here with you today. In summary, there was a, since the last session, there was a work group, the work group on prescribing, for prescribing authority for licensed psychologists, made up of three psychologists, two psychiatrists, a psychopharmacologist, and a general physician, who worked together to look at whether, what kind of curriculum and training and oversight would be necessary were the legislature to give authority to psychologists to prescribe under certain circumstances. The group worked from September 29th until January 11th, I believe was their last meeting, and came to a consensus on what that curriculum and oversight ought to look like. That then was put into Senate Bill 1046 that I believe is before you. And since that time, my understanding is that there are a couple of new drafts that are before you as well. But the group worked on a consensus basis, and they were, were able to reach a consensus. They had robust conversations about the different situations in other states in Louisiana and New Mexico. They looked at the what was going on in those states. Also looked at a variety of curriculums that are used for, they were used for optometrists and nurse practitioners and naturopaths, and looked at other information to make a determination about what they thought would be the best step forward. And I believe that that is what was in Senate Bill 1046.
All right. I know that we are getting emails from all kinds of people, and some are saying that because this was a closed system and private, that it wasn't a really good process. Can you comment on that?
I can comment that the legislation that set up the committee suggested that the committee members themselves could work with the facilitator to determine what would be the best process. They determined that knowing how controversial this particular issue is, that if they were going to be able to have really good open conversations that discussed all aspects, that it would be preferred to have those conversations as a work group. And as soon as the work group was done, they would share their work with the public. They did do that. They put out their first draft. They invited public input from a variety of sources. I don't remember off the top of my head how many different organizations sent us input that the work group then looked at, considered, and that's part from that consideration, that's part of what the initial changes from the Legislative Council back to the Senate bill. Many of the comments that we received were exactly what went on in the conversations in the work group. They really mirrored the conversation that was going on in the work group. And at the end of the day, the work group had decided that given the conversation they had, where they ended up was really the best of the worlds that they could combine together to come up with an integrated system to approach mental health issues.
Are there any questions for, Dr. Bates?
Who's going to be testifying today on this? Do you know offhand?
We have what's on the agenda, and then John McCulley was going to come forward, too.
All right, I've got 3, 4, 5, 6 people or 7.
Yes.
Those are the ones that will be testifying. I just want to state up front that I'm very concerned about this, and in fact, I'm actually not been convinced I'm a yes vote, I'm a no vote this time, and probably will stay that way unless I'm convinced otherwise, which is pretty unlikely. I think the intent of the legislation was not followed by the work group at all. and we'll discuss that as we go along here. I think they went off the track, did some things that were very inappropriate. And the emails I've been receiving, I have not received a single email in favor of this yet, and I got a stack of them this deep that I've been reading for the last couple of weeks. So I just want to be upfront about where I stand so people know. You know, I'm going to probably antagonize some of my House colleagues, be very angry with me for my position, but I've got to do what I think is right for the state of Oregon and Oregonians. At this point, I'm totally unconvinced this work group functioned properly, that it was made up of the appropriate people, or that really answered the questions that need to be answered. And so that's where I'm at right now. I'm willing to listen to testimony. I'll ask some pertinent questions as we go along.
Well, I do think that this needs to be clarified maybe right now, because I think that what we did is we charged this group, which actually charged the Oregon Medical Board to come up with three physicians. We charged the Oregon Psychological Examiners Board to choose three psychologists, and the Board of Pharmacy to choose one pharmacist to work together. So that did happen, and the charge was to come up with a curriculum. And I think that we need to flush your concerns out a little bit on what you felt the charge was.
The charge was, as I understand the legislation, I have signed on the legislation that they be psychologists who were registered and practicing in the state of Oregon. One of those was not. He was brought in from the state of California, temporarily licensed by the board, and brought in for this purpose. We license people in this state to practice what they are designed to practice, whether it be medicine, whether it be psychology, or something else. We don't license people to come in to serve on a committee to present as something new and something very dramatically different in our state. We don't do that. It's outrageous. It's outrageous.
So was,
and I think completely inappropriate.
So was,
and I didn't find out about it until a couple of weeks ago.
So
to me, that corrupts the entire process.
I think we need clarification then. Is that, was one of those members of the work group out of state then and not licensed in the state of Oregon?
I was not responsible for setting up the work group, as you said, Madam Chair, members of the committee, sorry. I was not responsible for setting up the work group. I had the work group names and information given to me to start to convene the group and follow along the scope and charge from the bill. The organizations that Madam Chair recognized were those that selected the members, and so I think it's best to talk to those organizations about who was present at it. I did not look at anybody's license. I took who was given to me and tried to do the best we could with the information and the charge that we had.
So is there someone here that can explain? Well, someone is standing up. Could you come? Who do you represent?
Oh, that's better for me.
Okay. And just introduce yourself to the committee to say who you are.
Again, Executive Director of the Board of Psychologists Examiners. All of the folks that we put forward for the group are fully licensed in Oregon.
Can I ask you a question, please?
Please.
Was one of those members recently licensed in Oregon?
That I don't know, but nobody's temporarily licensed. They're fully licensed.
Maybe my information is incorrect. I'll give you the name. Dr. Morgan Sammons. Is he licensed in Oregon?
He is licensed in Oregon.
And when was he licensed?
He's here.
I don't know. He's here. I don't know when he was licensed, but I know he's not a brand new licensee.
He did come up.
Does he practice in the state?
Yes.
Could you come forward and...
And
for the record, please introduce yourself.
Good morning. My name is Morgan Sammons. I am a member of this work group, and thank you for the opportunity to be here, and I'm sorry that my presence has attracted some untoward attention and focus. If I could clarify your concern, Senator, yes, I am licensed in the state of Oregon. When this issue came up in the spring, people asked if I would be a member of this work group, since I am a native of Oregon, and although I don't now now reside in Ashland. I'm building a residence in Ashland, and everyone knew my deep affiliation with the state and my deep affiliation with the prescriptive authority movement for psychologists. Asked if I would serve on this committee, since I've had a great deal of experience in designing curricula and working on this issue. So I received a temporary license upon that, and then I went through the usual process of applying for licensure in the state of Oregon. That license, the permanent license, was granted in the fall, and I'm now licensed in the state of Oregon and have every intention of utilizing that license.
Hello. I don't want to get this about one person. I'm talking about the process here. What do you practice at the present time?
I beg your pardon, sir?
What do you practice psychology at the present time?
I'm licensed in the states of Maryland and Oregon. My current job is an administrative job, and I currently do not practice.
Follow-up question. Where's your administrative job located?
San Francisco, California.
And have you ever practiced actively in the state of Oregon as a psychologist?
No, I have not, sir.
Okay. And follow-up question.
Mm-hmm.
What's your job in California?
I'm the dean of the School of Psychology, the California School of Professional Psychology.
And I don't know much about this school. Could you kind of explain to me what the school does?
I beg your pardon, sir.
What does the school do? I'm not familiar with the school there.
California School of Professional Psychology is one of the oldest freestanding schools of psychology in the country. Mm-hmm. We were formed in 1969 to provide a stream of psychologists who were well-versed and skilled in clinical practice. We've been in providing such psychologists for the past 40 years.
Follow-up question. Do you have a program there for qualifying clinical psychologists to have prescriptive programs?
Yes, and that's been well known for several years, sir. We have a postdoctoral master's degree in psychopharmacology. We have trained approximately 350 psychologists throughout the United States in acquiring the didactic knowledge to prescribe psychotropic drugs.
Okay. Madam Chair, I'm going to stand by my original statements. I'm going to stand by those. This is not directed to you, Dr. Sammons. It has nothing to do with you. The process in the bill and the intent of the bill was that psychologists licensed and practicing in the state of Oregon would be on this committee and look at the data, look at the information, and make a recommendation back to us. Bringing in someone who is has special knowledge and background in this, including having apparently worked in DOD and worked
yes,
in this
sir.
Area, was appropriate as bringing someone in for a witness and a discussion and bringing expert opinion in. We commonly bring in what we call the pros from Dover for various programs. We do not put them on the committee. We don't temporarily license them in the state of Oregon and give them a vote. To me, that is not what we were trying to do with that original legislation, and it corrupted the conversation. I'm going to stand by my original statements. Dr. Sammons has not directed you personally at all, and I want it to sound that way. It probably does. This is directed to the board. Okay? To the board. I'm shocked and amazed you did this thing. Shocked and amazed. Stunned. When it was first brought to me, I thought someone was making it up.
When was this information brought to you?
2 weeks ago.
And why wasn't I notified about this? Because
I didn't believe it, Madam Chair.
Okay, because I think that this would have been extremely important to have 2 weeks ago as chair of this committee that was going forward with this. We had a very tight timeline, and I am appalled that I was not notified because we need to move quickly. We only have until next week. To me, this looks like gaming the system to prevent something from going forward. With that, I would like to hear about the product of what came out. I can understand Senator Bates's concern regarding this one individual that evidently was not licensed practicing in the state of Oregon. And so that I'll have to look at. And do you have any final comments regarding
yes,
that?
Yes, Senator. If I could provide just one piece of clarification to that. I don't believe that the original legislation suggested that the members of the committee had to be practicing in the state of Oregon. And I think the people looked at that rather carefully in making their selection about who would best represent psychology and okay. best be able to contribute to this work group. I believe that I was selected on the basis of my expertise in designing these curricula, as I've been doing that for a number of years, both at the national level and in various states. Again, I apologize profusely if my presence on the committee was viewed as any kind of an attempt to alter the process. I've been open with the committee members and with the board from the very beginning about my status, and this was not a surprise to any, and my background and qualifications were well known to every member of the committee, and I'm rather surprised that it should be raised now as a point of contention rather than at the outset of the process, because my background and history was well known, and I believe that if I could address Senator Bates, when I testified in front of this committee last year, I stated my qualifications, background at that time quite explicitly. So I apologize again if my presence has altered or disrupted the process, and I would have happily withdrawn had I known that this was going to be raised as an issue.
And I view this as a political maneuver, and that's part of the process, too. So just a minute. Let's let Donna Silverberg state what the legislation stated.
Yeah, the legislation, House Bill 2702, said that there should be two psychiatrists, one of whom must be a member of faculty at Oregon Health and Science University. We had two from OHSU. Two psychologists licensed under ORS 675. Who each have a postdoctoral master's degree in clinical psychopharmacology or have completed the U.S. Department of Defense psychopharmacology demonstration project. One psychologist licensed who does not have authority to prescribe or dispense drugs and who works in a healthcare setting. One primary care physician licensed under and one pharmacist licensed under Chapter 689. As the facilitator person from Oregon Consensus that was in charge of the process, I thought that was who had been put on this committee, and I think everyone else thought that as well.
And it looks
so
like
I,
it was.
I appreciate the problems here.
I want to make this really clear. Dr. Sammons, this is not directed at you. You're not going to be neighbors.
Yes,
we're going to be neighbors.
Yes, Senator, we are indeed.
You know, it's a small town. I'm looking forward to seeing you and having dinner with you. Okay,
yes,
I can introduce you to some wonderful restaurants in Ashland.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, so this is not directed at you. It's directed to the board. Okay. Until I brought it up just a minute ago, you said you did not know he'd been temporarily licensed here, I think that if the letter of the law was followed, I agree with that. I said the intent. My phrase was the intent. The intent was to have local individuals who were practicing the state, know this state, to testify or be, I don't testify, to be part of this committee, to be members of the committee, to lead the committee. And bringing in someone like Dr. Sammons was more than appropriate, as an expert witness, to give them information, to give them knowledge, completely acceptable, welcomed, okay, but not as a member of the committee, okay, and that is the problem I'm dealing with here. It's a political issue, but a very important one. That's how we work our work groups. We don't bring people in from outside. This is an issue in Oregon right now, and that's my issue, and I'm going to stop right there.
Okay, with that, what I'm going to do is we're going to have clarification, and I think it is directed on the individual that was appointed, what we'll do is we're going to close this hearing, this informational hearing. We will resume it on Thursday, At this point in time, we have two other bills that we need to pass out. If we have time and if the committee wants to stay, we will continue this morning. I know that we have people who are here to testify, but at this point, I would like to close the informational hearing on the psychologist prescriptive authority. We may come back to it today, but we now need to move forward, and I will thank you very much for coming. And I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1003.
Okay. Would you like to briefly describe this?
Yes. Rick, would Mr. Bacobian, would you please describe what's in Senate Bill 1003?
Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 1003 is in front of you and basically allows the Department of Consumer and Business Services to grant an exemption from the required 95% retention rate for association health plans, and will allow them to work with the associations of these plans by rule. With that, I will probably defer. We have the insurance administrator here as well as proponents of the bill.
Okay, with that, I'd like to call Sean Miller, Teresa Miller, forward first. If John, do you want to come up too? But then Betsy Earls also. Those are the only four that are testifying. And we do plan to work session this bill, members, okay, if there is no opposition.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Teresa Miller. I'm the administrator of the Insurance Division at the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And in the interest of your time, I know that the three of us, or at least there were three of us, who presented this issue to you just a few weeks ago. So I can certainly be very brief in my comments. I've also provided written testimony that will probably look very familiar to you. But just briefly, in 2007, the legislature passed what was at the time House Bill 3321, which was intended to resolve issues about how the small group laws in the state would apply to association health plans. The bill exempts association health plans from small group rating laws as long as they meet certain conditions. And one of those conditions was that the association health plan maintain a 95% retention rate, which means that the association plan can't lose more than 5% of its members, with certain exceptions that were contained in the law. Since the law passed, we have experienced one of the worst economic downturns in recent decades, and we've had heard concerns and actually seen certain associations struggle with meeting that 95% retention rate. So the department worked very closely with associations and industry to develop legislation, which is now before you, Senate Bill 1003, that would allow insurers to seek a waiver from the 95% requirement. If this bill passes, the department will establish standards through rule to review waiver requests and ensure that the protections in current law aimed at preventing cherry picking would maintain intact. So with that, thank you for the opportunity to be here.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I'm here today on behalf of the Associated Builders and Contractors and the Independent Electrical Contractors in support of Senate Bill 1003. I know we did present to you about a week and a half ago just the policy of what we've been hit by in order to lose our association plans. And so Senate Bill 1003 is really just a stopgap to not disrupt the market in this economic times even further. And so we appreciate you, Madam Chair, sponsoring the bill, and as well as Senator Cruz. And so with that, I won't get into the details. I will point out, because we did not have the bill before us at the time, and so I just wanted to point out on page 3 of the bill is really just the language that allows the director to exempt plans from the 95% retention rate based on the rulemaking proceeding, which we feel comfortable with. And then on page 4 of the bill, it looks like a lot of new language. I just want to point out that actually is all current law except for lines 41. Line 41 is we added just a clarification to one of the exemptions where you would, one of the exemptions that does not apply to the 95% retention rate is when you no longer meet participation requirements for employers in the association, and one of those is failure to pay premiums. And so if someone's not paying their premiums, it doesn't count against that rate, which I think was the original intent. There was just some clarification that we all agreed to. And so that's the only line, even though it looks like a lot of new language. And so with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions, but we handed out written testimony that reviews the problem, and it has the Associated Oregon Industries, Associated General Contractors, and my clients as well. And so thank you, Madam Chair.
And the primary reason we had the 95% retention rate at the beginning was to avoid cherry picking, so that these association plans wouldn't kick out, so to speak, those that really did need, took a lot of medical care. And so when they come forward to you to ask for a waiver, you would be able to figure out whether this was happening or not. Is that
Madam
correct?
Chair, that's correct. We've looked at and actually discussed with those that we talked about this bill with some of the issues that we would look at, and one of them is the loss ratios of the small employers leaving the association compared to those that remain. And there we're really looking for, are the associations getting rid of the expensive groups, of the groups that they're not making money on, and those groups are then forced into the small group market, and those that remain are the healthy groups. So that's exactly, we have several ways we can look at that, and that's what we would be looking for.
Madam Chair, if I can comment on that, when we did come to the division and presented the data and the reasons why they left, one of the many examples of folks that actually left were people that were very good risk, and they were just employers in this marketplace, an increased number of people just shopping around. If they could save $10 in this economy, they were going to do it. And so so if someone was a very good risk and they left our plan, which our data indicated, those were being counted against our retention rate, when, in fact, if we were cherry picking, we were doing a very poor job.
Okay, further questions?
Madam Chair, because I just can't control myself, we need a broad-based premium tax based on consumption of the state, so we can cut down this kind of administrative cost that is killing the healthcare system.
We ought to get a work group going.
You know, that's a great idea.
Write a letter.
Yeah, you know, this is the kind of stuff that drives healthcare costs through the roof.
I think
trying to
right
play
right
with this stuff. We need to pass this bill, obviously, but
yes.
It's really true.
Any other
really
comments?
Yeah,
John Rakowicz and Betsy Earls.
Yeah, motion or anything is the worst.
Not there yet.
Sorry.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls representing Associated Oregon Industries. AOI worked with Sean and with the division on this bill. We were very interested in it because AOI also has an association plan. We made the 95% retention rate, but because we had members who I think were having trouble with the economy, there were a few times when we were a little bit concerned, not because they had any particular experience rating one way or the other, but if a company couldn't afford to pay their dues, or a plan couldn't afford to pay their dues within, you know, the association, they weren't allowed to be members of the health plan anymore, and that was counting against us, even though it didn't have anything to do with their experience rating or their health plan at all. So we feel like this bill takes care of the issues that we had, and urge your support.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, John Rakowicz, Oregon Chapter of AGC, Associated General Contractors. Keep it short and sweet. We're urging you to support this bill for all the same reasons that have been identified here. We're experiencing our industry, as many members know, we're down 34% from the beginning of this downturn in employment, from 117,000 to 75,000 jobs in the state of Oregon. It's a brutal situation. The majority of our members are small business. This is a big deal to small business. We currently have about 225 of our 1,100 members participating in this, but they're all shopping, and many of the better risk are, if they can get a better price, they're going someplace else. A lot of our small companies are literally surviving by project to project and bidding at no cost or negative gain. So this is a huge deal for us, a big deal for small business in the state of Oregon. Happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Okay. With that, I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1003 and open a work session on Senate Bill 1003.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1003 to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 1003 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered, I'll carry the bill, and with that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1003, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 147. Mr. Bacobian, please tell us what's going on.
1047.
What did I say? 1047.
Thank you, Chair. And Senate Bill 1047 is, again, one that you've heard over the past interim. In essence, it does exempt health insurance policies delivered or issued outside of Oregon from the 1% assessment that House Bill 2116 implemented in 2009. And it applies to premiums earned by or insurers on or after October 1st, 2009. And as you recall, this one you indicated during interim you wanted to attempt to fast track, given that the first day of the assessment would be bearing down quickly, so I believe that's one of the reasons for getting it on today's agenda.
Yeah. All right, and we have...
If there's questions, Mike Becker, but...
Okay, Marcia Kelly's the only one that signed up. Mike Becker, do you want to come forward? Might as well. Since there's no one else signed up for the bill.
That's the first day of the assessment.
No, not Mike.
Okay.
Marcia Kelly, the American Association University Women of Oregon, and I specified that I was neutral on this bill. I just have some questions on if you're delivering insurance policies out of the state, but the resident is Oregon. I thought that the idea was is that all of the insurance premiums on Oregon residents within the federal regulations would be taxed in order to help provide coverage so that we don't have the escalating costs with emergency rooms. And so I question why the rush to judgment when the first premiums haven't even been assessed at this point because of the time frame. I understand there might be some administrative cost in trying to deal with where residents are, but my health insurance provider doesn't have any problem in sending me out information about patient lines or anything, having an address to mail it to. So I would think that plans shouldn't have that much of a problem. They know where their bodies are because they know where they're paying the claims.
Okay.
So I just am questioning the rush to judgment when we haven't even had a chance to deal with this.
Mr. Becker, do you want to respond to that?
Certainly. Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, my name is Mike Becker with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. This bill is a technical fix to something that was unforeseen at the time we sat down and crafted the legislation in the past session. Ms. Kelly mentions, certainly the intent was to draft the language broadly and sweep in as much as we could with this 1% premium tax. The unforeseen consequence of that was in regard to out-of-state carriers insuring out-of-state employers who happen to have lives in Oregon. And the unforeseen consequence of that was we had no mechanism in this state to accurately identify who those out-of-state employers are, who those out-of-state insurers are, and how many of those lives actually reside in Oregon. If you look at the NAIC Schedule T of how premium taxes are identified around the country and what is reported, lives are reported in the state where the employer has its headquarters. So in the administration of the tax here in Oregon, insurers, insuring lives of employers who are headquartered here, pay the tax on all of the employees of that corporation, regardless of where they reside in the country. The flip side of that is where the problems come in, trying to identify those out-of-state employers with their lives in Oregon, and that is not something that is captured on Schedule T. So Oregon is, and rightfully should be, collecting the tax on all of those lives for Oregon-based employers, regardless of where the employees reside. What is in the too-hard-to-do category is that flip side. So this technical correction will cure that issue. It will save administration not only for the state of Oregon in trying to audit and document something that is akin to attempting to prove the negative. It will save administration for health plans and employers who are trying to monitor and identify where all of the beneficiaries of a policy reside throughout the country. And it will avoid double taxation of those out-of-state employers who are already paying the premium tax in the state where they have the headquarters of their corporation. I hope that answers the questions, and I will take any other questions from the panel.
So what health plans are headquartered in the state of Oregon?
I believe there are 9 domestic carriers in the state, although one of them is currently in a merger process with another. So there are 8 domestics in the state. But even out-of-state carriers who insure Oregon groups that are headquartered here in Oregon are paying the tax. That will not change under this technical fix.
So a health industry wouldn't necessarily, or could they, move their headquarters out of state to avoid this?
Chair Montes-Anderson, members of the committee, the status of a health insurer being in-state or out-of-state is not the determiner of whether the tax is paid. The tax will be paid and collected regardless of where the insurer resides. It is the status of the employer that is the key determinant of the tax.
So the employer of where the resident works is who is being assessed. The employer or the health premiums.
They pay the premium.
The premiums are assessed.
Chair Montes-Anderson, members of the committee, the tax is actually assessed against the insurer, but the insurer pays it on the lives for employers and individuals purchasing coverage in the state of Oregon. And that tax attaches effectively to those bodies regardless of where they reside, as long as the employer or the individual purchasing that coverage is in Oregon.
So Pacific Source and Health Net, the groups that have insurance with them here in the state of Oregon are being assessed.
Chair Montes-Anderson, members of the committee, that is correct.
Yes.
And and similarly, an out-of-state insurer insuring an Oregon-based employer will be paying that tax on all of those Oregon employees for that employer, as well as all of the employees for that employer who happen to reside outside of the state.
So Boeing, but maybe they're not a good example. They're headquartered in Seattle.
No, it's in Chicago, actually.
Chicago.
Excuse me, Chair. It's in Chicago.
Would they be assessed?
Chair Montes-Anderson, members of the committee, if they are part of, if that unit in Oregon is part of an entity headquartered outside of the state, they would not be assessed for the Oregon tax, but they would be paying, for example, the Illinois premium tax on those Oregon employees.
Okay.
Conversely, yeah. Madam Chair, Roseburg Forest Products, which does reside in Oregon but has operations in California, they would be paying Oregon taxes on their employees in California.
Chair Montes-Anderson, Senator Cruz, that is correct.
Yeah, just a couple more pieces here to it. First of all, I think this is probably a pretty small group of people, and it's sort of a quid pro quo. It's going both directions, as you've just pointed out. To me, the more important issue here is that this was a carefully negotiated settlement or decision in the last session, and the numbers we based this on, the 1% tax, was based on what we expected revenues to be for the way it was set up and the way we all understood to be set up. And that number could have changed to 3/4 or 1 1/8 or whatever. But it was designed for a specific program, insuring children and some adults. And we did not intend to try to tax the employees outside the state, or people who were domiciled outside the state. So this is really going along with the intent of that negotiation, and we do need to change it. It was an unintended consequence of those negotiations. Were long and difficult and very complex, much more complex than we ever thought they'd be. And I do not want to in any way disrupt the intent of that, of what we did with that 1% tax. There were four of us in that room, along with Mr. Becker and many, many others, and we got this thing done. It was difficult. And I don't want to in any way change the intent of what we did. And this would go along with what our intent was. Okay?
Yeah. Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Bates, if I might add, and I think this was implicit in your comments, that the revenue projections from the 1% tax did not include those out-of-state employees.
Correct.
So this does not change the revenue projection that was part of the negotiations and the intent of this law in 2116.
Madam Chair, can I ask you a question about timelines real quickly? When is the first assessment due? I don't remember off. Is mid-February?
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Bates, yes, it's due February 15th, which is, as Mr. Berkobian mentioned, the sense of urgency around getting this done as quickly as possible to save not only the administrative costs around paying the tax, but then having to refund it by the state to those other those carriers.
This could be kind of a nightmare to do, and I'm not sure we even have the ability to do it. It would be a mess. We just need to avoid this. I don't think we have a way of actually properly assessing and collecting tax or refunding it. It would be missing people. We'd be making all kinds of mistakes. We just don't want to do this, okay? Mm-hmm. And so we've got till February 15th. Today's the 2nd. We've got to run it to the floor, to a committee, to the floor, and to the governor's desk, and we got to do it in 14 days.
We can do it.
Well, we spent a lot of time, and I know the health authority has looked at this, and I think we had DCBS looking at this, and there doesn't seem to be any untoward consequences. And if there are, we certainly can address it next legislative session. So any other comments?
Yes. Monis Anderson, mm-hmm. Members of the committee. I would suggest that one of the things that you might look at in the future is how the states through interstate compacts could deal with these things if all of the states have assessments. Because there are large employers in the state of Oregon who have large blocks of workers but who are not headquartered here. One of them in Hillsborough. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yes.
They're self-insured. Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, if I might respond to that.
They're self-insured.
Just wanted to say this tax does not attach to self-insured employers such as the one unnamed employer in Hillsborough.
Right.
Yeah, that's true. Okay.
Or the Taft-Hartley Trust.
Yes.
Or Taft-Hartley Trust.
Not that we didn't try.
We did.
It was part of the discussion.
We did. All right, thank you. No further comments. With that, I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1047 and open a work session on Senate Bill 1047.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1047 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 1047 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered.
I think Senator Bates should carry this because he was part of the work group.
I'd be glad to.
Senator Bates is carrying the bill. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1047, and I'd like to reopen an informational hearing on the psychologist prescriptive authority. And there are some people who came out of town that are here, and I think it's extremely important that we hear what they have to say. I certainly understand Senator Bates' concerns, but we have, I think, a good product before us, and with that, I would like to call Rob Kohlfeldt, and is there any, okay, and Robin to come forward, please. Robin Henderson. Come forward. And then we do not have session this morning. The others who came forward, Dr. Chris Lockey and Bob Julian and Dr. Sammons and Dr. Wade, if they're still here, we certainly could have them speak also.
Okay. Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, for the record, I am Dr. Robin Henderson. I am a licensed psychologist in the state of Oregon. I have always lived in the state of Oregon, except for a brief foray into Washington. I will hold my testimony formally for Thursday, but I did want to briefly state I wanted to thank the committee for the creation of House Bill 2702. I was a part of the mediation work group. I felt that the process was well thought out, well handled. The mediator, Donna Silverberg, did a fabulous job, and we were all asked at the very beginning to submit our biographies to everyone. We submitted bios that were available for full review, so we have always practiced in the open. We all knew each other's qualifications and who we were, but I won't belabor that point at the moment because, as I do say, back in October, I remember submitting my biography for everyone's review. That said, I want to introduce you to Rob Kaufelt and Joe Gaines, who are two members of the military who have served our country honorably, and they would like to tell you about their experiences with the medical system. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Rob. This bill really needs to be passed because of the lag in the VA system of getting psychotropic medications prescribed as needed. As it stands right now, I see an outside psychologist and my doctor team at the VA, and I believe my psychologist has more knowledge of my mental stability than the VA, who I see every so often. The VA just wants to prescribe and not really monitor too well. That's the way I'm seeing it. That's where my psychologist sees me more regularly, twice a month. He knows my moods. He knows my medications, and he's willing to help me with that. If we can get this passed, he's for it. And I just don't like taking a medicine and having to wait 3 months to get another appointment with the VA doctor to tell them it wasn't working right, or for them to say, yeah, it's working, or running out of a medicine that you're not supposed to run out of because they take too long to refill them. And it's affected me and my family life. I spoke with you a couple months back about my relationship with my son and I wrestling around. I'm trying to work on controlling that stuff. I'm still having issues sleeping. I get up in the middle of the night. I'm thrashing around in my sleep where it's affecting my wife's sleep. My children, the twins are almost three, and they try to come in bed sometimes, and we're afraid that they may sneak into the room and startle me, and I may react like as if I was over there. And we just I need my psychologist, who knows me, to be able to help me out.
Thank you for your service. And any questions? And we see the need. And your residence is where?
Stanfield, next to Hermiston.
Next to Hermiston.
And I'll come down here a million times if you need me to.
Thank you.
Chair, I'm Joe Gaines. From Klamath Falls. I was over in Lakeview, but I moved a little closer. I'm the same way. I see my psychiatrist, and then my only way of getting medication is the same way. You have to have an appointment with the VA, but the person that's prescribing me my medication is actually a nurse practitioner. In order for me to actually see somebody in a doctoral doctorate, I have to drive 2 hours one way to White City. Before, I used to have to drive 4 hours one way when I lived in Lakeview, because that's who you have to see, is the White City area. So it's kind of hard to be at to keep in touch with the ones actually giving the medicine and telling them, you know, what's going on, because they do not see you on the on a daily or monthly basis, weekly basis. I see my psychiatrist once a week. And so it what's that?
Psychologist.
Psychologist.
We understand.
So it is difficult to go to all these different people just to get medicine for the help that I need, because I'm in the same way as Rob, where I've, all the issues I've been having, especially this past, I don't want to say this past month, it's been even more difficult on me, especially finding out a good friend of mine lost his brother 2 days ago in Iraq. So I'm even having even a worse time now than I did, say a month or so ago. And again, the people, the doctors, they don't see me over in White City, and the nurse practitioner does, but yet my psychologist is the one I talk to all the time and what have you. I see that he's the one that needs to prescribe, just because he does see my moods, my mood changes, my habits. So
you both have psychologists, is that correct?
Yes, civilian.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Yes,
just
Senator Bates.
Question, not for these gentlemen, for you, please. We're talking really here about a failure of the VA system to take care of our wounded veterans coming back. My experience has been that when I see one of these gentlemen, or in our case, many women also, and I write a prescription for them, they have to go, because I live in Medford, and I practice in Medford, they have to take that prescription to the VA system and then get somebody in the VA system to okay it.
Mm-hmm.
They can't take my prescription and go direct to the VA and get it filled. And most of them are in situations that they can't afford to get those prescriptions filled unless they go through the VA system. The cost of drugs is something that's prohibitive quite often. And so it's really a failure of the VA system here. We're talking about licensing or not licensing psychologists to write these prescriptions may or may not resolve these gentlemen's issues. They are especially acute because they live in Eastern Oregon. The last month getting to a VA center has been very difficult because of weather conditions, and that's going to continue on and off all the time. And even the weather conditions are good, it's a long, hard drive for people who are in some way suffering a disability from their service to our country. So the problem really is, from my point of view here, is the VA system. And I don't see this as a strong argument for it. Many people can write these prescriptions, but when you have to go through the VA system to get them filled, it's much more difficult. And it's a VA problem. I just don't see it as part of this argument, so help me out here a little bit, if you could, please.
Senator Bates and members of the committee, being a resident of Central and Eastern Oregon myself, I do see it as a provider issue. The lack of people who can appropriately diagnose and prescribe, even working with, we work with our VA folks over there. We don't have the resources. We see them in our own hospital clinics, and I don't have the providers available and able to do that. I'm in the process of looking at beefing things up in places like Prineville and Madras, because the VA system is there, but we have to get the accurate diagnosis and the medications on board at the hospital level, and we can and do see folks just like these two all the time. I agree that a good portion of this is the VA problem, but I also think it's a provider access issue. We need more boots on the ground out there. And we're not fixing the system with the current systems that we have. I understand that you're wanting to draw the connection cleanly and clearly between the two. And from your perception, it's like you're coming from this direction and I'm coming from this direction. And I don't know that I can bring you from where you're at. But I do believe that it is an access issue, and we need all the boots on the ground that we can get. This is a solution that has worked for the military. The DOD has done this for years, safely and effectively, and that's part of where this connection comes from.
Madam Chair, my comment is I read a lot of this, and I'm not an expert on it. I spent more time on it than I wanted to, frankly. I wanted the committee, the work group, to work this thing out for us. We do need more boots on the ground, but we need the right boots on the ground. The question is, what are the right boots? And that's what the work session was supposed to decide for us. And I'm not disallowing anything these gentlemen have said. I honor what they've done and understand partially what they're going through now. I'm not trying to cut them off from care. I'm much more concerned they're getting the best possible care. And maybe they're better judges of that than anybody else is, but I'm not convinced either way. And that's why we had a work group.
And Senator Bates, Chairman Sanderson, if I may. We had a work group that reached a consensus process on the issue, a consensus process. Not, let me be very clear, a majority process. This was not a majority. I have seen so many emails come from so many splinter groups of people who only come out when this issue comes up. It's amazing. You know, some of these groups don't even exist until this issue hits the floor, and then you get flooded with emails. It's right up there with fluoride. It's true.
Another one of my favorites.
And you know what? They weren't the people who came and submitted testimony and questions and things like that to the committee. You know the people on that committee. There were four faculty members from OHSU there. There were four. Count them four. And the two alternates for both of us were also people who work in academic settings. This was the best and the brightest that the medical board and the psychologist board and the board of pharmacy, I mean, we got the one psychopharmacologist in Oregon on this work group. You had the best and the brightest reach consensus on whether or not, you know, what it would look like if you did. What would it look like? The best academic, the best clinical, the best oversight, the best everything. We reached consensus, not majority, consensus. We all raised our fingers and we reached consensus.
We can have a
and allow me 1 second, I'm sorry, my apologies. But we reached consensus on what you asked us to do. We did that. Your job now is to decide whether or not we can do it. Questioning our process, frankly, for the seven of us in that room, that's not fair. We worked hard and long and smartly, and we were the best and the brightest people you've got. Honor the work that we did and make the hard decisions. Thank you.
Yeah, I'd like to respond to her if I could.
Sure.
Let these gentlemen speak first. They have
go
a right
ahead
to.
Thank you. We know that during this war we have a very extreme high suicide rate among returning veterans, both male and female. I honestly believe it's because we're not getting the care outside of the military. People discharged are done, they get out, and that's it. If the military could help us, even guide us to a private person that can help us, would be 100% ahead of ourselves. When the war came up, I volunteered to go. I had no problems defending my freedom for my children, for everybody else. But yet when I came back, just to get a little bit of help, it's been almost impossible. I've gone through loopholes and this meeting and that meeting just to be able to get where I'm at now, where I can see my private psychologist twice a month when they pay the bill. Sometimes they don't pay it, so he sees me for free. And I really believe if we can get something like this passed, we'd have a lot less suicide rate. Those people would feel more comfortable with somebody that's dressed in a shirt and slacks versus somebody that might be in a lab coat at a hospital called the VA. It's intimidating. It's overwhelming. And they're overworked. So, you know, all of us fought. Where's our help?
Thank you. Madam Chair, if I may, Senator Bates, when he started to speak, I knew the connection. The connection is the Oregon National Guard. I live in Central Oregon, where we have so many National Guard members and their families who are deployed. That's our primary base. We're not a military. I know this because I just went through writing this incredible Beacon Grant, and I'm looking at the connections for our Oregon National Guard members and our people in Indian Health. And, you know, people in Indian Health, psychologists can prescribe in Indian Health Centers and the DOD. And the connection really for us is we're not a military-based place. We're the Guard. And when the war is over and everything's over and they come back home, they're back on their regular routine insurance. And we don't have enough boots on the ground for that, Senator. So that's my connection.
I'll have that discussion with her on a private basis. I will take one issue with what you just said to me, though. You said it's unfair for me to question the process. It's my job to question the process up here. It's my job to question every process that comes in front of us. And so I do take, I'll take exception to that comment. We're all speaking rather openly here today on an open mic, so we might get a little excited. But it is my job to question that process to make sure the process worked well. And you did reach a consensus, but I've had, unfortunately, a private conversation with one of the members that reached that consensus. His position was, since this is a done deal, it's going to happen anyway, I want to put as many safeguards as I can in. He is not in favor of this. He's opposed to what the work group did, and he was in the work group. And we can bring him in here later to have that discussion. His position is, if it's going to happen, let's make it as good as we can. And that was his position.
Yep.
That is not a true consensus from my mind. So just so you know, and to the two gentlemen here, I served in Vietnam. So I went there a year myself. Came back, never went to the VA because it was a waste of time at that point. And it's not much better. These wars have fallen disproportionately on rural parts of America more than any other war in the past. And the VA is doing as much as it can on the resources it has, but it has failed rural Oregonians and rural people across this nation. And I understand your plight. And we will continue to work with the VA locally to give every bit of help we can to you. And I'm not disregarding anything you've said today. And thank you very much for coming. And thank you very much for serving.
Thank you. With that, thank you very much. I'd like to call up Dr. Bob Julian, Dr. Morgan Sammons, and Dr. David Wade.
Dr. Julian had to take off. My apologies.
Okay. He was the one physician that was going to testify. Go ahead, whoever.
Dr. Wade?
All right. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to speak here today. My name is David Wade, and I'm a licensed psychologist. I sit on the board of psychologist examiners, and I also have training in psychopharmacology. And I'd like to go back and speak to Senator Bates' concern about the process and Dr. Sammons. And I appreciate, Senator Bates, that you brought up that concern because, frankly, I'm looking forward to being able to explain at least my understanding of the process. I think it was probably me who brought up Dr. Sammons' name in the board meeting, recommending it, knowing that he was coming back to Oregon to practice. I thought that that made a whole lot of sense. And given the fact that here's one psychologist who's been prescribing for years, he teaches psychopharmacology, he's worked with many, many different facets, and I thought, gosh, as a psychologist, who better to have on this committee? And by no means was it my intent to mislead anyone, and I apologize if people felt that way, because, like I say, I brought up the name. And the Oregon Board of Psychologists Examiner, our charge is to protect the public. It's not to support special interest groups. It's to really look at what's on the table and support them. And so with that in mind, even though I do have training in clinical psychopharmacology, I had my board hat on and very much believe in the process and the due process. So again, it was me who brought up his name, and I was surprised it was an issue, because it was by no means meant to be misleading, because again, our charge on the board is to protect the public. That said, the board did have an opportunity to take a look at Senate Bill 1046, and we talked about it and reviewed it, and every member on the Oregon Board of Psychologists Examiners did support this bill. And based on the fact of the training and also looking at who's prescribing the medications, I know that you folks have heard the figures about 70 to 80% of psychotropic medications are being prescribed by family practitioners, whether they're PAs or nurse practitioners or physicians. Prescribing psychologists, in addition to having a doctorate in psychology, so assessment and treatment of mental illness, then, as you know, have the additional training of the academics in addition to the hands-on. So I won't belabor that point because I know time is short, but I did want to mention that. And another piece, though, I do want to touch on is scope of practice, because the question came up is, okay, what does the Oregon Board do as far as governing the psychologists and looking at the scope of practice? The board has adopted the American Psychological Association's Code of Ethics and Conduct, and I've made copies of that, or the board made copies of that for you folks. And it's been adopted by administrative rule, which means it has the power of law. Consequently, if a psychologist violates any of the ethical code, in addition to being in violation with the ethics, they're also in violation of the practice of psychology in Oregon. And certainly when that happens, the board looks at that and assesses, and there certainly are consequences for that. The question came up regarding children. Okay, if a psychologist wants to do psychotherapy with children, let's say, and they don't have the education, the training and experience to practice doing psychotherapy, they're operating outside of their scope, and that's going to be a problem. Likewise, prescribing psychologists, at least the way I see it, and I do work with children, is that if somebody, again, doesn't have all this training with children in addition to the psychopharmacology, they have no business, because you can't adequately prescribe if you can't adequately diagnose. And diagnosing children is not the same as diagnosing adults in many cases. So just in close, I'd like to say that the Oregon Board of Psychologists Examiners does support Senate Bill 1046 with the diminishing availability of psychiatric care in Oregon. We believe that this is an important public step to serving Oregonians who suffer from mental illness. And I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
So you're saying that someone who does not have a emphasis in child psychology and did go through the licensing to prescribe would not be able to prescribe children, or would not, because it wasn't, because they didn't have that particular training.
Okay, since this has not been implemented, I can just say that would be my expectation, and I think that that's the position of the board, because, again, they're not operating underneath their scope, which means that they're not operating ethically or legally. So I think this would be a very important component of this.
Senator Morissette?
Who would be best qualified to prescribe for attention deficit in children, a family practitioner or psychologist?
Well, Senator Morissette and the committee's member, the committee, excuse me. In my opinion, one who a child psychologist who also has training in psychopharmacology would be better served to prescribe than a family practitioner for the following reasons. Number one, having time to really diagnose that child and having time with them, using different measurements, adding dealing with the collateral information from school and home, and looking at history, and then monitoring them on a weekly basis, as opposed to seeing them, you know, maybe once every month. So in my opinion, the psychologist would be more qualified to treat that child for ADHD.
I did have a bill in 2003 that basically said that teachers cannot diagnose attention deficit. They can go to the parent and describe the problem. Interestingly, the person who helped me pass that bill was the representative of the company that made the major drug. And his experience was with his own child, and the teacher insisted that his child be put on Ritalin, and he said, no, my child is You didn't say it, but my child is smarter than you are, and he's bored.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, that whole thing came up, and so I often wonder if there's pressure put on the parent puts pressure on the primary care physician. The primary care physician says, "Okay, here's your prescription," and I think that's the problem. And I would rather have psychologists be able to actually prescribe for attention deficit.
Well, and if I might add, sir, being able to prescribe also means being able to take people off medications. And I've worked with plenty of children that I don't believe should be on these medications. And as a psychologist, if I could prescribe, that would not be my first line, except in extreme cases. There are a number of different ways and lots of literature out there regarding children and medications and adverse reactions. And so, yeah, I think that there are a number of components that you raise that are very important and need to be considered.
Senator Bates.
Just real quickly, is my understanding that the State Society of Pediatricians wants an amendment to this bill exempting people under the age of 18 from having prescriptive authority given to psychologists to write prescriptions for them and psychotropic drugs. I don't know if anyone here is from that association to represent the pediatricians. I'd like to have them come up and talk to us about what their position is on this. They seem pretty strong in what they're asking. Do you have any comments about that?
Well, again, I think in the best case scenario, we would have plenty of child psychiatrists out there that could do all the prescribing. And I think, again, if you look at the majority of people prescribing psychotropics for kids, they are, again, the family practitioners. And I think that having a child psychologist with the adequate psychopharmacology training and working in collaboration with the PCP is actually, I think it's safe and I think it's a good move, and it's an attempt to help fill the void because we just don't have the services out there.
Madam Chair, as I understand this bill, it doesn't require collaboration between the primary care physician and the psychotropic, writing psychotropic drugs, but maybe I misread the bill. But that's not really the point anyway. That's not really the point anyway. That collaboration is so difficult to obtain so often, it's just a matter of timing. I'd really like to hear from the pediatricians on this particular issue as quickly as possible.
We will be hearing the bill on Thursday, so there will be more people. We were time limited today. Thank you. Any more questions?
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Again, my name is Morgan Sammons. I was a member of the consensus work group, and to elaborate a little bit further on my previous comments. I do believe that the work group reached a consensus that is quite doable and protective of the interests of Oregon consumers of mental health services. I believe that we may have lost a little bit of sight on the impetus for this group, and perhaps I could spend a minute kind of redirecting our focus to that, because it is quite clear from the testimony we've heard earlier today and elsewhere that the status quo simply isn't working. It's broken, and this was an attempt to fix that. When I have listened to the comments of the two veterans who testified earlier, and as a retired Navy captain, a veteran, and a beneficiary of VA services myself, I can attest to the frustration that they've had in achieving services. And I'm very concerned about looming mental health problems for veterans, not so much for the veterans, but for their families as well. And their families are right now, as you all know, fairly completely excluded from VA services. The issue is not about where, at what particular point, an individual receives his or her services. It's about integrating those services in a way that makes sense for healthcare delivery systems and particularly makes sense for patients and their families. And the status quo is that those services are fragmented, they are unavailable, or they're inaccessible. The status quo is also that when a patient sees a physician for a mental health problem, they are almost always going to get medication, and almost always they get no other form of intervention. Those data are clear and persistently so. And it is equally clear that most mental health problems do not respond solely to pharmacotherapy. Yet that is the only treatment option that is being provided for the vast majority of patients who seek care. Psychologists are particularly, and I would say, bringing my biases to the fore, uniquely qualified to provide a range of mental health services that don't simply involve the prescription of medication. And the data are clear on that point as well, that people who are afforded combined pharmacological and psychological or behavioral interventions for mental health problems do better than those who receive one intervention alone for the vast majority of mental health conditions. As I said, the provisions in this bill represent a consensus-derived position, and we were particularly concerned with the issue of patient safety. I know that that's risen again in the context of children prescribing. I would say that any psychologist who has extensive doctoral-level training and a great deal of subsequent clinical training in diagnosing and treating childhood disorders would be a particularly apt person to combine medication as needed and psychological interventions to treat a childhood disorder. And again, the status quo that most children requiring behavioral interventions get one intervention, and that is medication alone. If they have a question about a diagnosis of ADHD, it is almost reflexive that a family practitioner is going to write them a prescription for a stimulant drug. And that is inequitable. If they were seen in the context of a fuller evaluation where they could benefit from a panoply of services, including behavioral interventions, a careful assessment, and whatever individual and family interventions are required along with psychotropic medications, I believe that unquestionably outcome would be better for that child. I believe that this bill provides appropriate protections for patient safety. I would say, as I've said in my previous testimony to you, every time non-physician healthcare groups attempt to expand their scope of practice, the patient safety issue is always risen, and every time it has always been, those fears have been determined to be unfounded. The patient safety is not adversely affected by expanding the scope of practice of non-physician healthcare providers, and I believe that that will be equally the case for psychologists that have the right to prescribe. Thank you, and I'm willing to entertain any questions that the committee may have.
Thank you very much. With that, I'd like to call John McCulley, Dr. Chris Lockey, and Ajit Jalani.
I don't know. I've got meetings.
Madam Chair, how much longer will we be?
These are the last three.
Okay. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John McCulley. I'm representing the Oregon Psychiatric Association. I'm going to let the two witnesses describe the issues and concerns we have with the bill. You're receiving at this point a position statement along with an outline of some suggested amendments that we're offering to Senate Bill 1046. And you will hear more in detail about those amendments and the reason that we're bringing them to you. Dr. Ajit Jetmalani, child psychiatrist, is head of the Child Psychiatry Training Program at OHSU. And Dr. Chris Lockey, on my far right, also works at OHSU and the Oregon State Hospital. I have a 10:30 appointment, and so I'm going to leave you in their very good hands, and I would be available to visit with you at any point in the future.
Thank you.
Hey, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I appreciate giving us the opportunity to speak about this bill. I know it's been a very busy session and you have a lot to do, but I appreciate your time. So I think before I get started, I want to say that I was also on this work group.
Say your name for the
record. Oh, yes, I'm sorry. I'm Christopher Lockey, and I'm an assistant professor at OHSU. I work at the state hospital through OHSU. I was also on the work group. I was an alternate member, which meant that if one of the members, one of the psychiatrists, couldn't be there, I would fill in for them for the day. And I can say that there was seemed to be quite a bit of pressure to get something passed, and that I know a number of the members didn't support or had concerns about the process and the ultimate product. But what I want to say is really three things today. One, I've been thinking about this for the last couple of years, being a resident here at OHSU and then also practicing. This issue has come up many times, and I've been trying to sort of figure out what the goal is, and I think we all can agree that the goal is safe and increased access to care in the state of Oregon, particularly for folks who have psychiatric illnesses. And I think that although this bill is a start, I don't think that this bill addresses those goals. Two, I think we have, as a legislative chair of the OPA, we have concerns about the creation of a separate training program apart from existing medical training programs that are already in place. The programs highlighted in this bill would allow people to get training over the telephone or over the internet, and I have a hard time imagining how to prepare someone to practice medicine, because that's really what this is practicing medicine. You have to be able to diagnose medical diseases that might cause psychiatric illness. You have to be able to treat those diseases. I think it also allows for folks without science prerequisites to enter a training program. I think that also is troublesome. I think people need training in science if they're going to be using science to treat medical diseases. We believe ultimately that the best way to increase access really to care is to bolster the existing medical programs. We have three programs in the state of Oregon. We have medical school, we have the PA program, and we have nurse practitioner programs. I think those prepare people to practice medicine. They have science prerequisites before graduate training. They have extensive clinical training and then didactics within those programs. Such as the new Corvallis psychiatric, or the new residency training program in Corvallis. That's one of the new programs. So we and other medical organizations are opposed to the bill in its current form, though if you choose to proceed, we've offered a number of amendments, and we've sent those to you, that would help, I think, reduce and I think address some of the concerns that we have and that other groups have. Now, today, we are going to have Tanya Tompkins speak. She's a psychologist, a professor at the School of Linfield College. She was going to give her perspective, which echoes the perspective of many psychologists about this bill and about psychologists prescribing. She will be available, may be available Thursday for testimony. With that, I would like to ask Dr. Gemmelani to talk a little bit about his concerns, and then we can go back and discuss some of the amendments.
Thank you, and thank you for letting me participate in this process. I'm Ajit Jetmalani. I'm a child and adolescent psychiatrist. I've practiced for 22 years here in the state of Oregon, and I am the director of training at OHSU Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. I also, ironically, I think, am currently actively volunteering my time for the House Bill 3114, Foster Child Prescribing Bill, and how to implement that bill. I'd like to speak specifically to the issue of pediatric psychotropic prescribing authority, which would be authorized by this bill. The premise of this bill is to improve access to psychotropic prescribing and care to children who are in settings around the state that are underserved. And most of those kids in underserved areas, many of them are served under the Oregon Health Plan, again, which is being addressed in House Bill 3114. I want to clarify with you exactly what is presented in the training materials that I've read for a person who would then prescribe to children. To my reading, from the program that the gentleman who just testified runs, the California School of Professional Psychology, and their website, pediatrics is considered a subspecialty training, and that training involves 12 hours of additional didactic training in that realm of medicine. there is 1 month out of 18 months of clinical experience for these trainees in the area of pediatrics. 1 month. There is no definition of numbers of patients seen, levels of acuity, a range of cultural diversity mentioned in this bill. Child psychiatrists, who, by the way, we saw the confusion between the term psychology and psychiatry. I can't tell you, every office party, dinner party I go to, I have to explain the difference. The public does not understand, and perhaps some legislators that I've spoken to haven't fully comprehended the range of differences between our professions. We work together well at OHSU with our psychology comrades in a very difficult environment, and I greatly value their expertise. However, child psychiatry training is 480 hours of didactic training. After having completed 3 to 4 years of adult psychiatry training, after having completed 4 years of medical school training, medical school training has hours and hours of both didactic and clinical training in pediatrics. We have 24 months of training after completing adult psychiatry to become a child psychiatrist. And the gentleman described perfectly what a child psychiatrist does, which is integrating biological, psychological, and social issues and coming up with a treatment plan that might or might not include medications in that plan. We are working actively with the Oregon Pediatric Society to develop a process by which we will consult with pediatricians across the state through telepsychiatry and other means to support their work with children when there are mental health issues involved. And clearly there's an access issue for kids in the state. The access issue really is for appropriate psychotherapeutic services, not for psychotropic prescribing. That's not the access issue. In summary, I think it's obvious that 1 month of clinical training and 12 hours of didactic training in pediatrics is grossly inadequate. And the reason why this committee, who worked very hard in a collaborative process to provide a product to you, failed to provide a product that's adequate, is that the request you made of them, I feel, was not meetable. The amount of time provided to retrofit a program around people who are not trained in medicine to begin with is a very difficult task. It's a very complex and difficult task. I'm proposing to you that if you do choose to move this bill forward, that you remove prescribing as a potential for anybody under the age of 18 under this bill. And I can tell you from working on the House Bill 3114 that there's grave concern around the current practices that are available in terms of overutilization of psychotropics in children. We really don't need more psychotropic prescribing. And frankly, the number of people that will go through this training, which will be quite extensive as it should be, even more than it has written, will be very limited. It will not solve the access problem. Thank you for listening to my testimony.
Senator Merced.
It's kind of interesting. One of the individuals who's going to testify, I hope, on Thursday is from Eugene. He runs an organization called Mind Freedom, and their goal is to get people off of psychotropic drugs.
Right.
That's their goal. And my feeling about that is I've always considered psychologists as kinder, gentler people who do the analysis and do the therapy without use of medication because they can't prescribe. Mm-hmm. So that's one aspect. The other, the question that I have, though, is the availability of pediatrics in rural Oregon.
Mm-hmm. Pediatric psychiatry?
Children. Just
working with kids in psychiatry. The availability is very poor, extremely poor. And this is why, rather than expect that we're going to train enough child psychiatrists to cover the deficit areas, we have chosen to support primary care physicians who are in those communities to do a better job in terms of diagnosis, considering options, and if medicines are appropriate, appropriately prescribing medication. This is a joint effort between Oregon Council of Child Psychiatry and Oregon Pediatric Society. Okay.
Senator Morris?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Jett Mahoney, thank you for coming, and Dr. as well. My question has to do with prescriptive authority. Does a family practitioner have the same prescriptive authority as a specialist child psychiatrist?
They do.
And then my follow-up question is, if they have that same authority, you're referencing the training for child psychiatry, which is, you know, very much a specialist.
Mm-hmm.
If you take the general practitioner dealing with a pediatric population, does the training of that general practitioner equal to or exceed, or is it less than, the training required in Senate Bill 1046?
The training around psychotropic prescribing, I would say, in terms of specifics around the utilization of psychotropics, would be less than the clinical training provided, and it would be more than the didactic training provided in pediatrics. However, the thing that is hard to comprehend unless you've flown the plane, if you have the rudder on, if you have the hands on the rudder and you know how to fly the plane, the notion is, how do you comprehensively understand how psychotropics affect the body? And this is the great fallacy of this whole process, is that an integrated understanding of how drugs affect body and how body affects drugs is lacking in the training. We expanded the training dramatically following this committee process. The initial proposal was dramatically less than what is now proposed. For all of you who've read the committee's process, the committee's outcome, that reflects a lack of understanding of the underlying complexity of psychotropic prescribing. Physicians who are in that position will at least know how to safely prescribe medication. Their problem will be not having adequate training to deal with complex mental health issues from a psychological point of view. So they are undertrained in that area. Psychologists will be undertrained in the area of medicine. And this provides a gap that actually endangers the health of the public.
Madam Chair,
yes.
Sounds like the problem is bigger than this bill.
It is a big problem that we're trying to solve with a cobbled together process here.
Can I respond to Senator Morissette? I think you brought up a really good point, which is that psychologists have expertise in their area of practice, and we have expertise in our area of practice. And I think that if I were to want to do what they do, I would go and get the training, and I would get the appropriate training. I wouldn't want to take a shortcut, and I think that that's what may be happening here. I think the work group felt pressure to pass something, and I don't want us to. I have concerns that pressure is also around here, and that for some reason we can't pause and kind of think this through a little more. And those are some of my concerns. And I think I want to say one other thing about access. It's more than just prescribing, having more medicines in the community. Access is about all sorts of things, funding and insurance and the VA. I've worked in the VA system. I know how different it is than working in the community. It's about recognizing that there's a problem in the first place, and that's for a big portion of folks with mental illness. That's the first step, recognizing that there's a problem. Many people don't want to be on medicines despite having a problem. We see this with folks who have high blood pressure, diabetes, or whatever, cancer. So it's not just about getting more meds out there. That's not the issue. That's not the access issue.
Dr. Bates.
Just a couple of quick statements. Senator Morissette, I couldn't agree more with what you said. You know, it's a big difference between going to medical school, an internship, and a residency, and spending hours and hours and weeks dealing with pediatric patients. And there's still a lack of training for working with psychiatric problems with pediatric patients. And the vast majority of primary care physicians, if they have any kind of a significant case in front of them with a child, refer that child to a psychiatrist, and rightfully so. And there's many psychiatrists that don't take on pediatric patients. They'll refer to a pediatric psychiatrist. It's that different, and it's that concerning, and it's almost scary to write those prescriptions, and I frankly wouldn't do it, and I know most physicians who are primary care physicians will not do it. The most complex organ in the human body is the brain.
we're talking about writing drugs for the brain here, and you just got to think this thing through. Doing this in a special session with the kind of pressure on us for the next 3 or 4 weeks, from my point of view, when you look at these proposed amendments from, these aren't splinter groups offering these amendments. These are qualified MDs saying we have concerns, and with these kind of changes, we would not oppose, not support, but we won't oppose the bill anymore. That just doesn't sound right to me. It just doesn't feel good to me. This is something that we, as a minimum, delay to a full session to have a longer discussion about. I just don't believe we're there right now, and I think this is premature to push this through. Two states have done it. Other states have all opposed it. We've had the same discussions in those states, I'm sure. There may be a time for this in the future, but I don't think it's in February of 2010 in a four-week session that we are really going to be rushed to put things through on.
We've been working on this for years. It isn't like we just came forward with it. I mean, there's philosophically, there is a difference between those who want this and those who don't. I mean, it comes down to that. So with that, this conversation will be continued on Thursday. Sorry, committee. With that, I'll close the informational hearing, I guess, that we had on psychologist prescriptive authority. Thank you very much, doctors, for being here. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for your time.